Hi everyone, I'm back home. It wasn't exactly a long trip. It was pretty much 6 days door to door to go and do the Salt Lake City thing that I spoke about last week. But 6 days is actually a really nice duration to be away, as it turns out. And I came home with not too much jet lag. And look, just a heap of good memories, I guess, which is nice. So very, very low stress. Now, I have actually had quite a busy week because I've found a bunch of stuff to write about. And in fact, these were a couple of things that had been on my mind for some time. And it just sort of, I don't know, like I used the flight to do some writing, and there are a couple of other things that happened which just sort of were the catalyst to eventually getting this out. Incidentally, I've got a lot of stuff in blog posts that's been sitting there in draft for a very, very long period of time. In fact, I pulled something over that I used to have in the old Windows Live Writer, which I was using when I used Blogger before I moved over to my blog as it stands today, about 18 months ago. And in fact, I pulled over one. See if these things, this is going to be an interesting one. I pulled over one which was about what I call something like fundamental financial strategies for software developers or technical people. Basically, talking about things that I reckon folks working in this industry can do to sort of focus on their prosperity over time. So, yeah, maybe this will be of interest to people. I don't know. It's very often with these things, it's very much I get an itch, you know, like something happens and I just brain dump a lot of stuff. And then sometimes I get busy and I do other things, and then something else pops up later on and I sort of round it out and push it out, which is what I've done with these two this week. So I want to talk about these two because they're both sort of quite important to me and quite close to me in different ways. And the first one was around the ethics of running a data breach search service. Now, this obviously relates to have I been pwned. And to be honest, though, one of the big things I wanted to do with this blog post is to explain why I have this service sitting there publicly searchable. Now, to be clear, and I think I said this in the post as well, there's something like 1 in 1,000 pieces of feedback I get are along the lines of maybe you shouldn't have this publicly facing, or maybe you shouldn't basically be able to enumerate because obviously the impact on privacy. And that is a very good point. There is that risk. And what I wanted to do in this post was to sort of explain why I do this. So why is it publicly searchable? Why don't I just send an email, for example, every time you search for an address, and then only disclose sort of via that back channel whether you've been in an incident or not? So the post sort of explains that there are multiple reasons for this, and one of the big reasons is that you cannot beat the experience, the user experience, of entering an address and getting an immediate response. So when I show this to people, and when other people show it to other people, they go to the site, they go, hey, what's your address? Put it in, bang, here's the answer. And it is so impactful for people to see where they've been exposed in these breaches and to get that feedback immediately. And I've seen so many cases where people have done this at conferences. I've myself seen so many times where they've done it in news pieces. The journo will go, you know, hey, so you've stood up this thing, you know, let me see what happens here. Put in my email address. Oh, holy shit, look, I've been in, like, whatever. And that just resonates and impacts people like nothing else. Now, of course, the alternative here, and this is what many people say you should do, many people of the 1 in 1,000, that is, what they say is, well, what you should do is just send an email. So, you know, you put in an address and then it says, okay, we sent you an email, go and check your email, and then that will tell you where you're exposed, or it has some sort of deep, unique link back to the site, and then someone on the site tells you. There are a heap of problems with this that most people don't realize. Now, I'll probably forget all the ones I wrote about, so go and read the blog post. But these problems include things like, first of all, email is, there's a delay, all right? It is not an immediate response. So you have to wait for the email to come, go to your mailbox, check the mail, what was the exposure? Even though that might only be, let's say, 20 seconds, there is a delay in that experience that just takes the edge off the impact. So, you know, that's part of it. I mean, an interesting fact, I don't think I said this in the post. When I first built this service, I put in a bit of an artificial JavaScript delay because the results were coming back so quickly. Like, I wanted to leave enough time for the thing to do this and to then go back up like that, because that that means that there's sort of this visual perception of it going away and searching, coming back with the results. So I actually had to artificially slow it down. True story. So, you know, that's part of it. The other part of it is it does take away that ability to sit there with people and go, hey, look, let's just check your address, because now they've got to have access to their email, which they may have in their pocket via a smartphone, but then they've got to wait for the thing to happen. The other thing that is enormously problematic, and this is the bit that most people really don't get, is that sending email reliably, at volume, and cost-effectively is basically impossible. Like, you have to give up on one of those things. Now, we'll start with the reliably bit. There's going to be a heap of incidents where that email is delayed. Now, it might be delayed because of the interwebs just being slow. It might be delayed because sometimes mail servers will throttle the ability to receive mail from a particular sender. So for example, when I load a big data breach and there's potentially hundreds of thousands of notification emails I need to send, I can see in my SendGrid portal the fact that, let's say Outlook.com, for example, is rate limiting the ability at which I can send. It's like, no, we're going to try a little bit later. Sometimes it can be hours before they send out. So there's that. There's also the spam issue. It is enormously difficult for me to reliably send email that doesn't get caught in junk. All of my email config is perfect. It is so perfect. You can go and do all the email tests and it comes back and says, you're not on blacklist, your SPF is good, your DKIM's good, the structure of your emails is good. I consciously don't even put any tracking tokens or anything like that in there, in part for privacy, but also in part for deliverability, because that can impact your ability to deliver. And even still, I had a heap of email, particularly on the likes of Office 365, going to junk. And I had to get in touch with people in Microsoft who then eventually managed to track it down and said, well, one of our upstream providers who does sort of reputation stuff had basically flagged me as having a lower reputation. We can't tell you why, we can't tell you who the provider is, but we've now whitelisted you on the Outlook side. So thank you, Microsoft, for that. However, you see the point. There are so many nuances to email delivery. So that's a problem. And then the cost side of things. I, at the moment, at sort of normal rates, I would have to send probably millions of emails per month, definitely millions of emails per month, if I had to send an email on every search. That would get very quickly into the thousands of dollars per month worth of cost just for sending emails. And if you don't believe me, go and have a look at the post, and I've got some screen caps in there from SendGrid which show this. And then people go, oh, well, maybe you should just use Amazon SES, the simple email service. Well, yeah, but that's a pain in the ass for many different reasons, which I do touch on in the comments as well. Things like, as soon as your reputation falls beneath a pretty high level, they start saying you got to fix it, otherwise we're going to ban you. And I found when I used Amazon SES, even though I have a double opt-in on all of my notifications for breaches, so double opt-in being that you've got to go and put your email address in and submit it, then you've got to get the email that comes and says, are you really sure you want to be in there? So all of that's there in place, but people still obviously were flagging it as spam, or reputation blacklist somewhere were flagging it. Reputation was falling, Amazon SES was going to kick me off. They didn't have any sort of neat portals which could tell you what was bouncing and what wasn't. Anyway, it's a freaking nightmare sending email at volume, cost effectively, and when my usage patterns are basically like flat, 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 heap of emails get sent because I just loaded a data breach, comes back down, flat, flat, flat. You see the point, right? So it's a very sort of volatile mechanism. Now, I really wanted people to understand that because it's enormously important. The other thing is that if I didn't do the public searchability thing and I basically said, okay, well, now I'm just going to, you know, send an email, it kills the API. A lot of people have built a lot of stuff off the API, a lot of good stuff. The API has been really good at expanding the horizon of Have I Been Pwned and socializing it into all sorts of other places, because people have integrated it into security tools. They've built iOS apps and Android apps. They've built all sorts of shells and scripts and things in different languages, which has helped expand the scope of the service. Now, and I'm just looking at my notes over here so I remember all the important things as well. one of the sort of things about that is that this is really what I've tried to do from day one, which is expand accessibility of it. Because the more I make it accessible, the more people use the service and they go, oh, look at this, I'm in a data breach. Maybe I won't use that same password everywhere. Maybe I'll turn on multi-step. Maybe I'll get a password manager. So the more people that can get exposure to this, the more people change their behavior, and the better it is for them, and the worse it is for the bad guys who keep trying to use all your credentials to do credential stuffing, etc. So socializing it and making it accessible is enormously important. And that's why I've made some of these decisions. Now, within this blog post, I also talk about dodgy sites. Now, let me qualify what I mean by dodgy sites. There have been various sites that have stood up, particularly since Have I Been Pwned, particularly since it's got a lot of press. And to be clear, this is not the first data breach search service. There were other things before Have I Been Pwned. And if I'm honest, I wasn't even aware of a lot of them because I didn't sort of go out and go, hey, that's cool, I'm going to copy that. I just went, hey, this seems like a good idea, let's do it. So in a way, I sort of didn't get tainted by those preconceptions of what a data breach site should do. But certainly there are many others that have popped up since. But they've done things like, in some cases, said, hey, anyone can search on this site, give us a few bucks, and we'll give you all the data for the account. So I can be like Mr. Bad Guy and say, I would like someone else's email address. Well, obviously you have that because that's what you search by. But I would like someone else's password, birthday, gender, race, sexuality. And there are sites out there even today that'll go, yeah, give us a few bucks. And they justify it on the grounds of things like, well, the data's public anyway, you know, like it's already out there. All we're doing is just, I guess, making the access easy. But they're still redistributing it and wrapping it into a nice little service. And they're still very likely going to face some pretty serious legal action if they get caught doing that. And as we've seen in the past, such as with LeakedSource, who got shut down earlier this year, people do get caught. Good takedown as well from Brian Krebs on who was actually behind that. So the whole sort of operating with impunity and anonymity, etc., generally doesn't tend to last very well either. There are other sites out there. There's a couple in particular that have sort of very similar name plays on Have I Been Pwned, operated by people with very, what's a nice way of putting this, checkered backgrounds. they're sort of, I won't go into it because I don't want to sort of name particular people or sites. But when you look at the individuals who are behind some of these, you sort of go, have you not learned? Do you not know what's going to happen as a result of you doing this? Some very, very mainstream companies, the way they run these is very interesting. So a good example is Experian. Now, many people have pointed me to the Experian dark web search, not a data breach search, dark web, because dark web is scarier. Many people have pointed me to the Experian dark web search, and I actually went and ran this myself a few weeks ago, and it was like, first of all, you go in and you enter your email address, and then before you click the button, you got to read the terms and conditions. And in fact, it's not just the terms and conditions, it's like the terms and conditions, the privacy policy, and something else. And you cannot search until you've read those. And if you do search, you are acknowledging that you have read those. And they total, I think it was about 27,000 words. You have to read the blog post. It is like a ridiculous number. And of course, in amongst those words is stuff like, well, we're now going to put you on our mailing list and we're going to spam you with things. And they took 3 days to do the search after I entered my email address. And then it came back with crap, which was like, here's your email address, you're in a data breach. Here's your password, and it's just all asterisks. And they don't say what the breach is either, which is just sort of entirely useless. So, you know, there's that side of it, which is kind of less shady and more incompetent, other than the sort of marketing upsides, that's shady. There are other ones that are doing just things that I think we would all agree, all reasonable people would agree, fall into the that's not cool category. Stuff like notifying organizations who are in a data breach in a very spammy way. So it's these are not organizations that are signed up, like the domain search on Have I Been Pwned. This is like, hey, random organization, we found you in a data breach, just thought you should know. Now, of course, there is an upside, whether there's an upsell and a product and everything. So it's, as I said in the post, I think I said it's ambulance chasing. So there's that sort of thing. There's another one recently was, I can't believe I even have to mention this. Someone was going through and replying to a whole bunch of people that had mentioned Have I Been Pwned and going, hey, why don't you check out our thing? And it's like, do you not realize how shit that behavior is? You know, like this is the whole thread hijacking thing. And I then went through and had a private conversation with the individual and had to explain why thread hijacking is frowned upon, and how if I was to perhaps mention publicly that this particular organization was going around thread hijacking, they would get a lot of not very nice responses. And in fact, I did this later on with a different company and I linked to it in the blog post. And this company was doing precisely that, just thread hijacking. It's like, hey, it looks like you're interested in widgets. Have you tried our widgets? And after I did publicly shame them, they just got piled on something shocking. So this is what I mean, where there's a whole bunch of shady sort of behavior. And the feeling that I'm increasingly getting, and stuff like Equifax recently only adds to this, is that people see that data breaches are a goldmine in terms of organizations who sell access to them. And look, there are ways of doing this ethically and responsibly, and there are other organizations out there that are doing this, and they're bundling it in as part of other products and things like that. And that's cool, that's awesome. That contributes to the objective of trying to raise awareness and hopefully making them less impactful when they happen. So I by no means have any issue whatsoever with other organizations doing this responsibly, but it does just feel like people are trying to capitalize on the misfortune of others when they exercise some of those behaviors that we saw before. So anyway, have a read of that. So this is one of these blog posts which will for a very long time become a reference point that I direct people to. So when someone pops up and goes, and in fact this happened like literally the day after I wrote it, they popped up and go, I don't know if you know, but you've actually got an enumeration risk on your site. I was like, that's not a risk, it's a feature. Like, this is the way it works. Here's why, because there's the blog post. All right, so that's that one. Now, on to something else. And this was another thing that I've been passionate about actually for about 20 years now. In fact, more like 22 years now doing the maths. And it is about how important are qualifications to modern technology jobs. Now, as I say in the blog post, and I only posted this last night, so I've only got sort of early feedback so far, there were a couple of catalysts for me writing this. And those catalysts occurred in very recent times. So one of them was Equifax, and it was the fact that the Equifax CSO did not have a university degree in a security discipline. And there were headlines out there about Equifax CSO had a music degree, ha 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 ha. And obviously the innuendo of the headlines here was that she was ill-equipped due to having a music degree and not some sort of InfoSec degree. And really, I think what was happening here was this was just sort of part of everyone piling onto the dumpster fire that was Equifax, where they're looking for every single possible hole, because let's face it, they stuffed up a lot of stuff, like just royally stuffed up a lot of stuff. So organizations like journalists and media outlets were looking for every single possible reason why this could have been a bad thing and making headlines out of it. This was a bad headline. It was a bad reason to say that someone, and I think in this particular lady's case, approximately 30 years ago, got a degree in something different to what she's doing three decades on. And it just didn't make sense. And then the other thing that happened, of course, was last week I was at Pluralsight Live. You know this. And whilst I was at Pluralsight Live, I was giving a lot of thought to the way people are learning and the amount of information that is available for people that want to have careers in technology, be that programming or InfoSec or IT operations, whatever it may be, because there's 6,000 plus courses in the library, and a lot of them have been used by a lot of people to really transform their careers in ways that we just couldn't do in times gone past. Now, the relevance, I guess, to myself here is that it got me thinking a lot about my own career and my own education, and in some cases, my lack of education. And my story, as I explained in the blog post here, was that I went to university in 95, is when I started university, here on the Gold Coast, where I'm now living again, only about 10 minutes from my house. And I started a computer science degree, because I was doing a lot with computers. I was working part-time in all sorts of, you know, computer-based roles. And I thought, okay, well, you know, this is cool. We'll do the computer thing and I'll do something in the industry later on. And then when I hit uni in 95, I saw the internet for the first time. And I was like, this is awesome. You know, this is so cool. I want to build internet or internet things, websites. You know, like, this is great. Like, I'll just choose a subject which teaches me how to do that. And the closest I could get to any of this was stuff like COBOL. Actually, there was a relational database design course. In fact, I remember it because I pulled some books. I found in my book cabinet this one. And in fact, it's funny because I was looking at this book just the other day. I tweeted a photo of this and a couple of other very old books. And I would have been using this book no earlier than 95. It might have been 96 or 97 during another subject. And the funny thing that sort of resonated with me afterwards is the copyright date on the book, which, as you may be able to see for those of you watching the video, it was back in 1988. So a seven-year-old book in technology at the time I was learning it. So anyway, like, that is just a good example of how, I guess, how hard it was to learn what I wanted to learn at university. So I went out and I instead bought this book. And as you can see, this is a fairly well-weathered book that I still have today. I don't tend to use it as a reference today. And I suspect, wow, it actually came with a disc. Remember when books used to come with discs? There must have been a CD on this somewhere. I was just wondering if this had such quality pieces such as, let me see, I haven't actually even looked this up. There is a whole topic on Macintosh, which is interesting, in an HTML book. I assume that they have wonderful things such as the marquee tag. I don't see a lot of marquee tag these days. Good reason for that. Anyway, point is that I went and got this book because I could not find anything in the degree which was teaching me what I wanted to learn. There were certainly things in the degree teaching me things I did not want to learn, such as chemistry. And I have always sucked seriously at chemistry because, frankly, I just don't understand it. And if I'm honest, I really don't want to understand it. It's just not one of those things I'm interested in, and it's irrelevant to what it is that I do today and what I wanted to do back then. So as I explained in the blog post, I sort of went through the degree, and as I was going through the degree, I was starting to work in the web. I was building stuff. There was demand. We were approaching this sort of dot-com era, particularly as I got through to about 97. And I ended up going part-time because I had some really, really cool work doing actual interesting stuff. And there was still nothing at uni about the web. And then eventually I dropped out, but I think that the correct terminology was I basically put it on hold. I mean, you know, I'll put it on hold and then I can come back to it later on. But of course, you know, now I actually had experience and I was working for companies building things. And I didn't put this in the blog post, but I ended up going off to London and working in London for a year. For those of you in London, I did the original web interface for the Kahoot Bank. So if you see that, I was doing the client side using a lot of things I learned from here to build a bank, or at least the web front end for a bank. And, you know, like, I did that, came back to Australia and had plenty of work to do. I came back just at the right time at the tail end of the dot-com before things kind of burst. And there was never any shortage of work. There was always stuff to do. And the degree, or the fact that I'd only completed, I think, about 80% of the credits, never ended up worrying me. And when years later I did go back and I looked into completing the degree, they're like, oh, yeah, all your credits have expired. You know, like, you can go and start from scratch. And I'm going, but I did the courses. I got the credits. I did quite well in some things. Like, why? Anyway, apparently that's the way it works. So the whole thing about the blog post was not to say don't go and do formal qualifications. Now, be that university degree, a lot of people in Australia said, what about TAFE courses and diplomas? It's not to say don't go and do certifications. There are a lot of certifications out there. I've created content for the CEH certification. So it's not to say don't go and do that, but rather that is one path. And the interesting thing about this industry is that there are many different paths that people take. The Equifax CSO and the music path. Now, she's probably not the best example to use because a lot of stuff did go wrong under her watch. But there are lots of other people out there that have got degrees in all sorts of other unrelated topics, and they have somehow found their way into programming, InfoSec, IT, all this sort of stuff. Now, I gave the example in the blog post of my dad. And my dad was a pilot. He retired about 10 years ago now. And on one of his last flights, he had an engine blow up, which is something that I understand you don't really want to have happen as a pilot. But basically, there's like flames and stuff everywhere, and he flies the plane around, lands it, you know, everyone's okay. And Dad always had to do so much study. Like, it was just constant studying. Even though he'd been doing it for decades, and he'd come through the Air Force and flown everything and had all of this amazing experience, you still had to keep doing this. And if you don't, I mean, okay, if you don't, then you simply lose your license. You can't fly anymore. But if people didn't, and they're flying around airplanes and they have something like this engine fire, well, people die, right? So this is a very, very serious industry to work in, and they have a very, very high standard that has to have this oversight and qualifications. We don't have this in tech, and there are people that will argue that you should. I noticed someone very passionately defending that position on Twitter today, saying there should, and there should be regulations and government bodies and tests and certifications and everything. And of course, if we did have that in this industry before you could build software, there'd be no Facebook, there'd be no YouTube, there'd be no lots of things, because that would actually cause many other problems in terms of people's ability to actually build systems. So it's certainly not a simple thing. But regardless of how it should be, the way it is at the moment is that people do come from all these different backgrounds. Now, when I wrote this post, I wasn't quite sure what to expect. I thought that there would be some very passionate arguments on either side of the fence. And it was kind of one of those days, it's like I got up and there's, you know, a dozen or so comments or something on the blog post. I think about 18 comments when I woke up. And I was like, I wonder what I'm going to be in for now. And I was really surprised on both the comments and also on the Twitters that there were no really passionate arguments for doing the formal qualification thing. Now, there are plenty of people who had, so this is not to take anything away from them. But the one sort of consensus that everyone seemed to have is that experience is enormously important. Whether it is experience alone or experience and, I don't know, Pluralsight or CEH courses or whatever, or whether it is experience and university degrees, there are all these different routes that people come at, and it doesn't kind of matter how you got there, but the fact that you have arrived and you have something at which you can now build a career on is the most important thing. Now, there are sort of a few pro arguments for universities and colleges if you're in that part of the world, particularly things like, look, it does sort of set you on a path. It's like you're now on a journey. You're going to spend years going down this path, and it is going to lead you somewhere in a way that sort of self-paced, self-study, go and learn from, you know, contributing to open source or something, doesn't. And that is a very fair argument. And there are many, many cases where formal qualifications make sense. If you are sitting there here today going, I think I want a career in, let's say, software development, but I really don't know where to start, I don't know where I want to specialize, going and doing something like a degree is awesome. That helps get you on the right track. It surrounds you with people with common interests. It exposes you to things because you're sort of on this journey, and it's going to take you along, and you're going to see all these things along the way. There are other people for whom that's very difficult. It was very difficult for me because I'm probably a bit anti-establishment in that I don't like formal structures. I always hated school, never got on at school. And that didn't work very well for me, but obviously the end result now has worked out very well. So I guess sort of the overall kind of story here is that it is interesting today that it is very infrequent, or increasingly less frequent, that I hear about organizations requiring formal qualification. So I don't see a lot of people out there today who say, look, I went to go for this job, but I didn't get it because I didn't have, say, a degree. There are still lots of organizations out there that do require certain certifications or qualifications for certain sorts of roles. So I gave an example of the Department of Defense in the US needing certain certs for certain types of roles. But hey, that's a cert. That's a much more easily achievable thing than, say, a 3-year degree. And I guess that the point I sort of make in the blog post, which I think is particularly important, is that the value of things like certifications and qualifications, all this sort of stuff, that the main value is to someone else. And what I mean by that is that it is someone else who sees that and then says, okay, because you've got that, we're going to give you, you know, this role or that role or that role. I think for us individually, the experience is the number one most important thing, because that's what's going to actually let you deliver when you get that role. And increasingly, we're sort of seeing a bit of a shift here where organizations are going, okay, show us what you've done. And in fact, this was my first blog post. My first blog post was about, let's create online identities, because online identities are a great track record of what you've done. What are the questions you've answered? What are the what are the sort of GitHub projects that you've contributed to? What are the conference talks you've done, or even the conference talks you've been to? You know, how do you actually demonstrate independently what it is you've been involved in and what you've done, as opposed to just saying, here's a piece of paper I've been given for passing, let's say, a cert, and here are some references who are friends who also am awesome. You know, like, that is not a great way of independently establishing whether someone is a good candidate for a job. Now, all of this as well, and I actually didn't put this in the blog post, but I think it's important. All of this doesn't speak to, is the person a nice person? Are they really passionate about what they do? Do they get on well with teams? There are all these other things that contribute to how effective a person is going to be in a role, beyond the certifications and beyond the sort of hard technical skills experience too. And I guess that the interesting thing about all of this is it just makes it a very kind of diverse landscape. And to the point earlier on, people have come from all sorts of different backgrounds to do what it is they do today. So to wrap it up, getting back to things like the Equifax CISO, it is just such a bullshit, pointless argument to say, this is what someone did in their formal qualifications decades ago, and then let's not worry too much about what they've actually done the last 30 years. You know, like, that is so arse about, it's just ridiculous. All right, so look, that's that. Have a read of that. I think it's an interesting thing. I'm really, really happy about all the feedback I've had on that, which has been very positive. So, you know, thank you for everyone that's contributed and added their 2 cents to the story as well. So last thing, sponsor is a Semantic Website Security this week. So Semantic's been on board. I think this is about the third time they've had a week of sponsorship, and they will appear again in the future as well. So big thanks to those guys. My sponsorships are full up, I think, for about another 2 months until late November. And I will actually try and start thinking about filling those gaps a little bit more in advance this time as well. So look, that's all that. I've got a heap of other stuff that I'm working on at the moment that some of it you will not see coming, which is going to be really awesome, that I hope to be announcing during October. Things that I'm really excited about. And now that I'm back home, I have time to focus on. So I'm back home for the next couple of weeks. And then over the remainder of the year, I've got some Aussie conferences and other events and trainings and things to do. So I'll come to you from some other cities. But other than that, I'm back in Oz in the sunshine until I go to London in Jan, which is not sunshine. It is something very different. So thanks for watching, everyone. And I'll come to you from here again next week.